The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Look, I don't know if you normally pray or not, but although the statistics I read some years ago about atheists praying were somewhat disappointing, they seemed to me to pray almost more than Christians did, some of them. But either which way, I'm going to lead in prayer that God would make this useful, and if you don't like praying, just have a sleep, really, for a few minutes. Our great God, thank you for this beautiful planet that you've put us on, full of interesting people and beautiful people and beautiful places, and also lots of things that now are going wrong. But we thank you for the gift of life, for this place, for this night. We pray that you would help me, please, to speak truthfully and usefully and helpfully, that you would help us to feel free to think fresh thoughts, to challenge old thoughts, and to come away understanding things as they really are a little bit better. We pray for courage, and for those who may be sleepy or have things that are worrying them, that you would particularly help them to stay awake and help them to focus on ultimate things. And we pray for this in Jesus' name. Amen. Right. What's in my right hand pants pocket here? This one. What's in that? Come on, you look pretty clever. Can't be all that hard, can it? What's in it? I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll pull out, there are three things in it. I'll pull out one of them. And you an honest man? You can hold that.
Sure.
Yeah. If anyone can work out what's in that pocket, you can have the money.
A golden ring.
Now, yeah, there's two things. And don't give me fresh air and stuff like that, because it's not that fresh anyhow. But, I've put two things in there apart from my hand. Yeah, do you want to have a guess? Are you clever? You're expert on pockets?
my own pocket. $20.
Good guess, but completely wrong. Who'd like to have a go? Come on, $50.
Change.
There is in this pocket, but not in that pocket. Two things, yeah.
iPhone.
What?
A Bible.
A Bible, could be, but no.
Perhaps should be.
Yeah.
My hand,
yeah, that's one of three things, but there's two other things. Last one.
Mobile phone.
Could be a mobile phone, but it isn't. Now, Mark, come out here. I'll show you what's in here, okay? After this meeting, where am I going and what am I going to do? I am going somewhere, well, unless I die, and that's always possible. Carrying a bit of weight, heart, who knows? Where am I going? What am I doing? Sorry? Could go home and sleep. It's a long walk to Sydney, but I could. I could do the long walk. Yeah, I mean, see, it's funny, isn't it? Because lots of you look quite intelligent. But you've got no idea what's in my pocket, and you've got no idea where I'm going or what I'm going to do. Although I am going somewhere and I am going to do something, I know exactly where I plan to go and I know exactly what I plan to do. The problem is there are just some things we don't know. Now, the things I've raised with you are very little significance. Of course, if I had given him $1,000 and a gun and said, give the $1,000 to anyone who's right and kill everyone who's wrong, then you'd be really thinking, what does this guy have in his pocket? Because it suddenly becomes a thing that is a matter of life and death, and it suddenly becomes a thing that may greatly benefit you. $1,000 could make a bit of difference to how you spend the weekend. Now, the question of what happens to us after we die. I won't labour the point, although perhaps we need to, that the one certainty of your life is your death. You may never have sex with anyone. You may not finish your degree. You may never get married. You may never own a house. You may never retire. I may never get to Malta, which is the thing I said I'd like to do. But the one thing that I know about you is that you're dying. In fact, a great man from the 17th century who wrote very significant works that have affected the world was in the process of dying. He knew he was on his deathbed. And he had a secretary writing letters to friends. And he wrote, "Dear so-and-so, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the living." He paused and thought, no, cross that out. He said, "Dear so-and-so, as you can see, I'm still in the land of the dying. I hope soon to arrive in the land of the living." Now, as soon as I start talking like this, I feel as if I've got to say, look, I don't mean to be morbid or depressive, but it's strange, isn't it? Because it's very hard, at least where I grew up, you know, in Sydney, very hard for us to speak frankly about the most ordinary subject in the world, which is death. There was a period some hundreds of years ago where wealthy young Christian men in Europe would not uncommonly have a skull of a real person on their desk. So when they sat down to work and to plan and to do their budget and, you know, do their business or to finish their studies, there was a skull, and some of them had written around it a verse that said something like this, as you are, I once was, as I am, you soon will be. And see, again, why? It was to help them be realists and to realise in the end, death is the great certainty, which is why in every culture, at some point, people try to work out what happens at death. When I was an atheist, I really liked the idea that there was nothing after death. Sometimes people speak about, people only believe in God and believe in life after death because it makes them feel better. Right? It's a comforting thing. But they don't realise that if you're an atheist, that's a nice thing to believe too. Because it means that when you're dead, you're just asleep. And being asleep is quite nice. Really, I like sleeping. But, you know, the idea that there might be life after life is that's interesting. It can actually be a worry. It depends on what you think that's like or what's going to happen. So why don't you spend a few minutes around your table just discussing the sorts of different views you've heard people say about what happens after death. Somebody might like to jot the headings down, you know, like, do you understand what the question is? Just want you to, what are the sorts of different pictures or statements people make about what happens to a human after death? Right? You don't need to believe them or disbelieve them. Just jot a few down. Discuss that around. So you've only got a couple of minutes, so don't get, take too long warming up. Okay, you've got 60 seconds to go. You've only got one down, you're going to fail. Yes.
Okay. Let's have one from the super table down the back. One of the possibilities of what happens to a human being when they die. Read it out, loud voice. Just
reincarnate.
You know, the karn part comes from meat. So to reincarnate means that the soul transmigrates and then is re-meated. Right? So the incarnation of Jesus is Jesus becoming meat, becoming, it's the Son of God, becoming flesh, carnivores, chili con carne. Okay, you got that? Okay? So reincarnation, it means that the soul, when you die, it leaves, it transmigrates, and it is reincarnated. Maybe not as a human, maybe as something else. Through all sorts of, there's a thousand different possibilities within that model. Okay, thank you. Over here, did you have another one? Different one? Reincarnation we had there, yeah?
Somebody said that there's a whole world we can't see. But the real aspect of spirit, when we die, our body is like, when we get out into space, you've got to have a space suit. To live on Earth, you've got to have an Earth suit. Well, this is what our body is, it's our Earth suit.
Right.
And then when we die, we actually, somebody said that when we still live, it was sort of trapped, that the angels pull us out.
Okay. And did they say where the soul might go? We think that's what happens, but then we don't know what happens next?
Well, depending on what your views are.
Okay, now, thank you. That view of the... I remember hearing a very fine man explain this. And he thought it was a Christian view, but it's actually a very Greek philosophical view. You'll hear people say it, and Christians say it sometimes, and they mean well, when they say that the body is a prison for the soul. And the soul... It's not quite as it, but the idea that the soul actually at death is released from it being, you know, encapsulated, and in a sense it's a blessed release. That comes from a particular, so that gets muddled up with Christianity sometimes. Because it sees being in flesh as being a bad thing. That's actually exactly what Christianity doesn't believe. If you go to one of those churches that says one of the old creeds, the early Christians worked out three great creeds. Apostles, the Nicene, and the Athanasian Creed, and they all finish up with a statement something like this: "I believe in the resurrection of the body." And sometimes people who just said that, I've never. What a weird view that is! Christians do not believe in spirits floating or something like that. They actually believe that you will have a body of some sort. And we can talk about that. Okay, so reincarnation, some sort of escape from this sort of earth suit. Any other views? This table here, go there.
Purgatory.
Okay. Purgatory, to purge something means to make it clean. And then presumably what happens after purgatory? Presumably in Catholic, that's a classically Roman Catholic doctrine. You go to purgatory. Only good people go to purgatory. And you purgatory is a step on the way to heaven. In Roman Catholic theology, classical Roman Catholic theology, that doesn't mean all Roman Catholics believe it, but they should, that the only people who die and go to heaven directly are the saints, you know, the big guys and gals. Everyone else dies and goes to purgatory, so every other Christian does, then they go to heaven, others just go straight to hell. Okay? So purgatory is where the good people go. So when John Paul II died, the Pope, the official statement from the Vatican was, pray for the rest, for the repose of his soul. Right? Because they don't know if he's in purgatory, which is just like hell but shorter. So it's no joke, purgatory. It's, but its intention is different. So John Paul II might be in hell, in purgatory. In fact, that's where he is unless he's a saint. But apparently if you're a saint, you get to go straight. That's another... There's all sorts of different pictures and patterns. There's, of course, when you're dead, you're dead. That was my favourite one, you know? When you're dead, that's it, kaput. Right? Yeah? Game over, ashes to ashes, food for worms, etc., etc. That is at one level chilling, at another level a release and a relief. There are thousands of possibilities out there, but the main ones are probably when you're dead, that's it, kaput. Reincarnation, which is particularly seen in Buddhism and Hinduism. I think it's fair to say that Buddhism is, in a sense, a different sort of, it's a sort of reformed Hinduism, in a sense, but the basic structure of the universe is similar. And then you've got the views that some sort of a judgment after heaven, hell, sort of stuff. I take funerals as an Anglican minister, not as many in the job I'm doing now, which is a relief. But just off the record, I don't say this at funerals, one of the things I find really difficult to cope with, I find funerals generally difficult to cope with, but the game that gets played that everyone's gone to heaven. In fact, when I was a young minister, fresh out of college, the guy I was being trained with said, Ian, no matter what, never go in the hearse, in the family hearse. Even if you have to catch a taxi, just don't ever go in the family hearse. I said, why not? He says, because at some stage someone will turn to you and say, John, my husband, Dad, Uncle Bruce, whoever it is, he's in heaven now, isn't he? Everyone looks at you. And the only answer you can give is yes. In the social dynamic, any other answer is the wrong answer and is offensive. And so Jim said to me, don't do that, Amy, because you'll find yourself put in an impossible situation. And often everything you know about the person indicates that they're probably not. You know, not that I'm their judge, but you know that there's no indication that... but we all play this game that everyone goes to heaven. I joke with friends, how come only good people die? Everyone who dies, when you talk to the family, oh, he was a great guy, fantastic husband, really blessed him. No bad people seem to die. I did do one of my first funerals. I gave this really nice eulogy about this guy. I came outside and there was a guy smoking. He was just sort of at the door. I said, oh, hi. Did you know the guy who died today? He's my stepfather. I said, really? I said, well, what was he like? He said, sound like a nice guy. He said, he's a bastard. So I thought, right, I'm going to be more careful. So I then began to say, I have been told he is. I was told he was like this. You can end up accidentally telling falsehoods. Now, the problem you see with this whole thing is we don't really know. There are lots of genuine opinions, and whatever opinion you have about life after death, you need to face the fact that there are literally billions of people who disagree with you. And I mean, I'm not just, you know, that's not preacher's rhetoric. There are billions of people who flat disagree with you. And many of them are smarter than you. Many of them are more stupid than you. That's, you know, that's just the way it is with any point of view. One of the questions we could discuss, but we're just for the sake of everyone, is to think, it's interesting to ask people, if ever someone tells you what they think is what happens after death, ask them nicely, on what sort of evidence have you got that that's true? What do you base that on? So you can have all sorts of theories about what's in my pocket, but you've got no evidence, have you? You can be the smartest people in the universe. You know, you can get together the greatest brains in the world who specialise in pockets and what 58-year-old men put in their pockets and all this sort of nonsense. It's not going to do you much good because you're ignorant. Just don't know. So the only honest position is agnosticism. Yeah.
That is one person that went to heaven and came back to tell us, Jesus Christ.
Well, the Christians have got a peculiar argument about Jesus, which we'll come to. You may have met people, because I've met people who have died for a little bit. It's what, when I did the St. John's Ambulance course, is called clinical death. As against biological death. Clinical death, when you stop breathing, you've got about 3 or 4 minutes before you begin to fall into biological death, when your brain dies. That's when you're really dead. When you just stop breathing, you're very close to death, and someone better do something quickly. So Kerry Packer, famously, the wealthy Australian, well, he's dead, so he's not very wealthy now, but the once wealthy Australian, he was playing polo, and he had a heart attack. Or the ball should have had the heart attack. But he had the heart attack, fell off. Thankfully for him, the ambulance that came in Sydney, Warwick Farm, was one of the few ambulances we had that had those things you whack them on your chest and they bring them. And up he came. And so he as a mark of thankfulness, and very publicly, as a lot of his, not all, but a lot of his gifts were done quite publicly, he gave to all the ambulances in New South Wales the set of sticks. Right, now he then was quite famously, and I've had a lot of my atheist friends quote this back at me, he said, Kerry Packer said, I've been dead, there was nothing there, there was no light, there was no God, there was no judgment. Right? And people think, there you go. And that, I've met people who've had after-death experiences who have met God and whose lives have been changed by it. I just don't think either is actually really good evidence. You know, like we just don't know what's going on. With Kerry Packer, I think it's a bit like someone saying, you've got a picture of Sydney, I don't know if you know Sydney, it faces east, we've got beaches there, Bondi and others. It's like someone swimming out 200 metres out from Bondi, coming back and saying, there's no New Zealand. I've been out there, I've swum, have you swum that far out? No, I've swum 200 flipping metres out there, there's no New Zealand, it's a rotten mist. I don't know where those weird people come from, but there's nothing out there. And I want to say to them, keep swimming. It's out there, and turn a little south. Keep going. See, Kerry Packer wasn't dead. He was only very close. He was playing on the edge. He was clinically dead, but not biologically. If he'd been dead for an hour or two, or 3 days, something like that, then I would have been interested to hear what he had to say. But here's the thing that he never quoted, and I was always delighted to share this with my atheist friends. He rang up Australia's most prominent atheist back then, called Philip Adams. And we had Philip Adams for a debate at Sydney University once, and Philip was chortling about this. Packer rang him up. They had property next to each other up in Hunter Valley. Kerry Packer rang him up and said, Philip, I've been dead. He said, I'll leave out the swear words. He said, there was no blankety blank light, there was no blankety blank God, there was no blankety blank judgment. Which means, this is the crucial part, we can blankety blankety blank do whatever we damn well like. And see, when people say to people who believe in life after death, you just believe that to make yourself feel good, believing not, the choice to believe there's no life after death is just as psychologically convenient. Right? It's just a question of who uses that stick first. So don't get bluffed on either side by this. The question is, who's got the evidence? Where is the evidence? See, now, when I became a Christian, just after I left high school, soon after that I finished up being a youth worker, and in God's irony, I was sent into high school to try and convert young heathen Sydneysiders, which is what I wanted to do. But I noticed that after about a year, the most frequently asked question I got was, I would say something like this: when you die, you're going to meet God face to face. Someone would rock back on their chairs, a reasonably tough little school. They'd say, how do you know? And then I'd say, well, I'd often say, well, how do you know that isn't the case? What do you think happens? When you're dead, you're dead. Food for worms. I'd say, how do you know? If you ask a man a question he doesn't have an answer for, he normally just talks louder. So they'd say, well, how do you know it's wrong? I'd say, no, I'll tell you why I know it's wrong. I want you firstly to tell us why you know it's right. You've made an assertion, you know, as if you know something. Tell us, a learned one, on what do you base that opinion? Well, they don't have any basis, really. You can examine the body. No one is suggesting that the body is going to tell you what's happening. Human beings aren't quite that stupid. They think that you can tell that. Everyone agrees that when a person dies, the body decays, etc., etc. But that was the question. And if I want to use a big word for those who like big words. It's the only big word for the night, I think. Epistemology. Okay, it's one of the three or four big areas that you study in philosophy. And it's the study of knowledge. How do you know what you know? And how do you know that you know what you think you know? It's a very important area. How do you know anything? And there are different ways that you access knowledge. The way that you know a person is different to the way that you know granite. The way that you access knowledge about history is different to the way that you access knowledge about the atom. Some dopes don't realize this. So some very fine scientists, who are very good in their particular area of discipline, speak as if the whole world can be explored just using the methodology of science. And that just means that they actually need to do more thinking and reading.
precise is a magnificent, powerful tool that Christians invented, and it's very powerful at a few magnificent areas. We're all the better off for it. But it simply, it won't help you know if your girlfriend loves you, right? And things like that. It won't even help you work out if your mother loves you. So the question, how do you know stuff? See, what you have is our problem. Here's our fundamental problem with this question of life after death. There's thousands of opinions, three or four main opinions that we call the great religions of the world. Right? There's thousands of opinions held by very clever people and very stupid people. But they're just opinions. They're not facts. There's many ideas sincerely held. But there's precious little evidence. There's precious little evidence that is checkable, outable. Right? People have personal experiences, like near-death experiences, they're called, when a person gets very close to death. But people come back with such different reports. There's certain things that are similar about them. I've read some very fine philosophers, not Christians, but who find the cumulative evidence from many cultures, what happens in there, some of those near-death experiences, convincing evidence of something. I don't, frankly. They may be right. I just don't want to hang any evidence on that. Lots of theories, very little knowledge. Like what's in my pocket. You just don't know. And this is not a thing the Bible's unaware of. So let me show you one of my favourite verses. I'm never going to write a book, I don't think, but if ever I was going to write a book, the first chapter would be about this verse. It's in John chapter 1, verse 18. No one has ever seen God. No one has ever seen God. And in the original language, it means exactly what that says, but it's slightly stronger. It's basically, no one has seen God ever. And here's the problem. See, when it comes to the question of God and all the ultimate questions, we don't know. We have not seen. We don't have good evidence. Let me draw you a diagram that I find helpful. If you don't find helpful, I'm sorry to waste your time, but somebody might. Here is a little diagram. Here's where you live. I'll put you here. There you are. And you're happy. Because it's Wednesday night and you're cross, what are we at? Cross cultural, whatever. No, you're here. So you're happy. I'm back up here somewhere. And I'm really happy because I'm in the parish of the South. But I'm much better. So these points here, so this is birth, death. That's where you live. That's where we live. Or if you're more poetic, the womb to the tomb. And that's where you live. Now, because you're busy and because there's lots of distractions and fun and pleasure and blah, 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 you can often get through life barely thinking about any serious question. But every now and then, human beings will. When things happen. It can be an experience of extreme beauty. It can be just a thought that comes into your head from nowhere. It can be something that comes to you listening to music. It can be something that you think about at a funeral. At some point or other, almost every human, I think, starts to ask some ultimate questions. Big questions. Questions like the one we're looking at tonight. What on earth is out here? Because the way it works is we had this in that's this. Birth, death. Whatever's on the other side, you know, it goes on. You're gonna be a long time dead. Right? Thousands, millions, billions, forever. This life is very important. The Bible never, Jesus, the guy I follow, Jesus never suggests this life is unimportant. But it's short. And you've got to see it in perspective. Right? This is an important question, but we just don't know. If you stop and ask the question, not does my culture have an idea, does my family have an idea, is there some program I saw on some documentary channel, which is a great way to learn about the universe, does it have a view? But we just don't know. And you can ask questions about God, and these questions are linked up because if there is some afterlife and there is a God, these things will obviously be interplaying together.
We ask, what is God like? Again, if we're honest, we just don't know. There might be many, it might be she, it might be he, it might be an it. You can have the stupidest of all ideas. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. We're going to ask about that. Because you might think it. One of the silliest things I've ever heard that is common where I come from is people talk about, oh, God's not a person. He, she, whatever. It's a force. It's a loving force. Really, a loving force. How's that work? How can you have loving electricity? When there's an, or, you know, a loving current in the ocean, or a loving tidal wave, right? It's stupid. It's just nonsensical to put the word loving next to the word force. People are desperate to avoid God being a person, because you've got to deal with the person. Why many of us would rather have our best friend being a dog, because they're so much. And I get it, because dogs are gorgeous, you know, and they're much more consistent than humans. But, but you know, it's sad in the end. Better than nothing. But a loving, we don't want to deal with a person, because then the persons are demanding. You might have to answer to them. But so you think of God as a force, then we put loving in front of it, because we're influenced by Jesus in the end, whether we like it or not. Well, we ask the question, what about me? What am I? Am I just a wet computer? Is that all I am, really? Is that the best definition of me? Everything in me is just a question of chemicals. I think I fall in love, but that's really just a bunch of chemicals. And if you're a consistent atheist, it's very, very difficult to avoid that conclusion. Atheists, I've read, desperately try to avoid the fact that in the end, what you really are is a bunch of chemical processes. You think you love someone, it's really just chemicals in the brain. We'll unpack it in the end. Everything is reduced to chemicals. That's okay. That's the way it is. But what I, you know, is it just a question of handing on my DNA? In which case, I might as well die and get out of the way. I've got three beautiful children, and just taken off oxygen. Right? I've done the job, I've reproduced. Get out of the way. or are we something else? So we actually don't have answers to any of these questions. And often you don't care. But then every now and then something will come and you'll suddenly become a serious human being and think, what is this all about? And if you ask that question at the dinner party, normally people will try to change the subject. They'll give you a bit of a joke, have another drink. Right? Please don't be serious. Socrates, a great Greek thinker from sometime before Jesus, who in the end was put to death for asking too many questions. Well, as far as we can tell from history, He went and talked to all the religious leaders of his town and worked out that by asking questions that they actually knew nothing really when you pushed them and asked them questions. And he finished up with a conclusion like this. He said, we must wait until a god comes from the gods or a man is sent from the gods to tell us of the gods. Right? We actually just don't know. And there are some times when it's much better to say, I don't know, than to pretend you know something. Agnosticism, as that's called. You just go, I don't know. That's much better than saying, this is what I think. If what you think is actually worth nothing, or has got no validity, it's better to say, I haven't got any real idea. I'm just waiting for more information. So there's our problem, folks. So when it comes to this question, we honestly just don't know. So people tend to say stuff that just makes people feel better. Right? That's what people do at funerals. They just say stuff that makes people feel better. And I get that. That's loving your neighbour. But in the end, that's dangerous. Because this, whatever's on the other side of death does not change because you believe in it or not. Right? If in the end there's nothing on the other side, that you believe there's a heaven and a hell or reincarnation doesn't change what's going to be there. Right? Reality is the thing that hits you even when you're not aware it's there. Right? Every now and then you hear sad stories of wonderful, good nurses who accidentally give the wrong tablet to the wrong patient and the patient dies. The intention and the sincerity is fundamentally irrelevant. There are certain things that are true and certain things that are false. Now, I understand that attitude changes things. But in the big questions, we need to know what's out here. But we can't know what's out here. So that's what the Bible says here. No one has ever seen God. In all the big questions, no one's qualified to speak. Jesus says in John 6, very similar thing. No one has seen the Father,
This is the problem. See, no one has seen. No one's qualified to speak about God, who seems to be the only one who can really tell us about this. Therefore, in all the ultimate questions, we haven't got answers. You know, we can work out E equals MC squared, although I don't think most people have the faintest clue what that actually means. But we can drop all these bits of knowledge that we have, but we can't tell. Basically, because no one's ever seen God. People have asked to see God. Moses asked if he could see God. I don't know if you know anything about the Bible. Moses, one of God's really good friends, he'd seen God act magnificently in ways that shocked and pleased Moses. In the end, he said, God, I just want to see your glory. And you might remember God's answer, Moses, I can't. No one can see me and live. If God was to turn up in this room, right, as he is, you would not get to go home and write the final work on what God is like. Right? You would cease to be. Right? The sun, it's 93 million miles away, if it turned up in this room, you wouldn't write the final book on what the sun's doing. Right? Because it's just too powerful. If God, and the sun is nothing. God has made billions of stars bigger than the sun. No one's ever seen God. The Bible's aware of the problem, and it wants people to face. Any questions on this before we move on? Yeah.
Jesus said, "Who have seen me? I've seen God."
Did he? Yes, that's a big claim. He might be right.
He's totally right.
We'll come back to that. Can you think of anyone else in history who's made that sort of claim? If you have seen me, you've seen God. I can't. There is no way that Muhammad would make that statement. In fact, I think if Jesus made that statement in the presence of Muhammad, Muhammad would have killed him. It's blasphemous. Isn't it? It's a disgraceful comment to make, really, at one level. If you want to know what God is like, look at me.
Really?
I mean, who do you think you are to say that? Sometimes if you've been going to church for some time, you can not get... That is an extraordinary statement to make. Particularly for a Jew. Not so much for a Greek. And not so much for certain sorts of Hindus. Hinduism's a funny word, because it really... But that's another thing. It's an English invention for the religion. And I'm not saying the religion. When the English got to India, they found this extraordinarily complicated religion, and they put a name over the whole thing, and they called it Hinduism. And it's questionable if there is such a thing, really. But in much of the religion of India, to say that, you know, the gods walk amongst us, it's like the Greeks. But if you're a Jew, at this point, like a Muslim or like a Christian, we've got this view of God as there's one God. He's the maker of everything. He's transcendent above everything. He's other than us. For a Jew like Jesus to say, if you've seen me, you've seen God. You know, it's hard for us to get the size of that statement. The Jews were either right to kill him, or that small group of Jews who worshipped him were right to worship him. But any other position doesn't understand what he's saying. All right. Well, let's have a look at because I've only read part of the verse for you. We're here, John 1:18. No one has ever seen God. John 6, Jesus speaking, says this: No one has seen the Father except. Now that's interesting. Jesus saying universal ignorance. No one knows. No one has seen. No one is qualified. Lots of opinions. None of them worth anything. Not that anyone has seen the Father except, okay, Jesus says, he thinks there's an exception, except the one. Now Jesus thinks there's one exception. Right? No one has seen the Father except the one who is from God. Only he has seen the Father. Moses couldn't see the Father. Jesus is saying there's a guy that the Father has sent. And if you read through John's Gospel, the most common phrase Jesus uses to describe himself is that he was sent from the Father. He's the original missionary. Right? That means to be sent. So this is Jesus talking about himself. He often speaks of himself in the third person. Like he uses that phrase, the Son of Man. So Jesus says there is one exception. See, we're all in the dark. One exception. John 1:18, to go back to that verse. No one has ever seen God, but God, the only begotten God, it's a very strange phrase that in the original, but the only begotten God, which is that's a weird way to speak, so translators have trouble trying to translate it. They should probably just translate it literally, probably. But the only begotten God, who is at the Father's side, he has revealed him, he has made him known. So what John 1:18 and John 6:10 are the same thing. Total lack of qualification. No matter how clever you are, how many degrees you've done, how many years you've gone studying the great religions of the world, etc., nobody knows what happens after death. Nobody knows what God is like. Nobody knows what the purpose of being human is. Although we can probably get some hunches towards that more than the other two. Jesus, there is one exception. And it's me, he says. It is an extraordinary claim Jesus makes. It's similar to what Jesus says in John 8. He uses a slightly different but related image. Jesus says this in John 8, verse 12. Jesus spoke to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. The Pharisees challenged him, saying, here you are appearing as your own witness, your testimony is not valid, and have a big argument. By the end of the chapter, they try to kill him. Right? But hear what Jesus says. He does not say, I am a light in the world. I think most Australians could put up with that. He is one of many lights. Buddha, Muhammad, Confucius, Zoroastra, etc., etc. Jesus doesn't say that. He says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness. The assumption is we are in the dark. He says, I've come as light in the world. I'm the light. And we really need to see that on the background of our obvious problem, if we're hard-headed about it, we don't know what's on the other side. We know we're going to be there for a long time. And frankly, those of you who are young, which is not me, a certain percentage of you will get there in a hell of a hurry, because young people die by accident. But old people like me, we tend to die by cancer. We get a chance to warm up and go to it slowly. But young people, they tend to get there quickly. Every now and then, they catch you by on the hop, so to speak, unexpected. But what Jesus is saying is, I am the qualified one. I know the Father. I've seen the Father. In fact, John 1 begins with this statement about Jesus, using the word for Jesus, one of the many titles, the Word. Okay, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. When was the Word with God? At the beginning. Right? So when the beginning was, there was God with the Word. So they were there before the beginning. You got that? It gives you a headache, this stuff. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So that there's God and this being called the Word is with there together. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. There was never a time when God was on his own. God is always, he is they, is basically what it's saying. From the very beginning, he's an expert on God. And when it says he was with God, the word actually means he was leaning towards. It's a word of intimacy. Now, this being called the Word was leaning in towards God. But there was this lovely, I don't want to trivialize it, a bit like you see a couple who are in love. They sort of lean in as they walk together. It's that sort of picture. He's an expert on God. He's an expert on, look, verse 3, through him all things were made, without him nothing was made that has been made. So saying, through Jesus, through the Word, everything was made. The sun that we mentioned, the earth, everything. All made by him. Nothing was made apart from him. So you will never see anything, no matter how far our telescopes get to the end of the universe. It's all, it's got the art of signature, made by Jesus. Right? If you like, the Father was the architect, the Son was the builder. and they worked in this collaborative way. In him was life, and the life was the light of all people. This is the one who became flesh. Right? This is the only begotten God. And he has come and made him known. He's exposed God. He's you can know what God is like. You can know what God's going to do with you after life and after death. Right? That's the claim. Now, we've already established the fact that you're all ignoramuses about what's in my pocket. Right? Except who? Who's the one qualified person? Mark! Now, you might look at him and say, seriously? Now, if you want to know what's in my pocket, and I'm not going to tell you. If I offer you, I'm not going to offer you. You can just have the prize. Tell me how you can find out what's in my pocket. Ask Mark. Mark, what's in my pocket?
A lighter? Cigarette lighter.
In the pocket of an Anglican minister? Are you serious? I don't smoke cigarettes, don't panic. That's hard to believe, really. The earphones make sense because I was on a plane this morning. That's possible. Cigarette lighter is very unlikely. Now, if you leave the building tonight and you turn to the person that you're with and say, what do you think that idiot had in his pocket? Right. If you say, I don't know, how can I possibly know? What are you saying about Mark? You're saying something about Mark, aren't you? What are you saying about Mark? He's not trustworthy. He's point blank told you, what did you say it was again? Yeah, so if you go out of the building, and I know you won't because you've got more important things to talk about, and say, what was in that goose's pocket? Your interesting question displaying ignorance of what was in my pocket is a statement about this man's integrity, isn't it? You are actually saying, this man is a liar. Or if he's not a liar, I can't trust him. You know what I mean? Like, you might be saying he's a liar, but you are saying, I can't really trust what he said. And so, you know, this gentleman here told us what Jesus said, I mean, in John 14. That the disciples had been with Jesus for 3 years. It's very much like what Moses said to God. You know? Oh, it's been fantastic seeing all this stuff. I want to see you. And Philip says to Jesus, you know, it's been really exciting, Jesus, but if we could just see the Father, then we would be satisfied. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's the ancient question. We want to see God. We don't want to do it by faith. We want to see him. And then Jesus gives this extraordinary answer. Philip, have I been with you for so long and you don't know who I am? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That is unthinkable for a Jewish person to make up, as John is a Jewish person. There is no parallel to that in human history. This rubbish people go on with about all the religions are the same. You can only say that if you've never studied any of them. Right? There's nothing like Jesus claiming anywhere in the world, seen me, seen the Father. Right? Elsewhere, Jesus said, if you've heard me, you've heard the Father. Right? Jesus says, to reject me is to reject the Father. If you don't worship me, you don't worship God, Jesus says. Very powerful. There's alignment between him and the Father. Right? Absolute. And then similarly, so in a sense, Jesus is God's audiovisual. You want to watch God? Read the Gospels. And you can watch God go to a funeral. You can watch the few times Jesus gets angry and find out what makes Jesus angry. You can see the sort of people who are the friends of Jesus and people who aren't. And it's shocking who are the friends and who aren't. Jesus actually says to the very, very good men and women of his day, and they were, the Pharisees were good, they died by the thousands to defend monotheism against the pagan Romans. These are good, sincere men. Jesus says, the prostitutes and the tax collectors, these are not tax collectors in our culture, are good. We don't like them, but they're good. Right? Tax collectors then were people who'd sided with the Romans and betrayed their own people and sold their souls, because if you became a tax collector, you weren't allowed to go to the temple. So he picks prostitutes and tax collectors. He says, the prostitutes and the tax collectors are going to get into the kingdom of heaven before you guys. Kidding? I mean, Jesus, he is not saying, religious, devout, sincere, are we? Tick, you're in. No, he says, you're almost more liable to miss than anybody else. So you watch who Jesus is friends with, discover who God is friends with. Listen to what Jesus says, or elsewhere, that one of the two or three times in history when God actually speaks from the heavens, you can actually hear his voice if you're in the right place at the right time. Happened on Mount Sinai. And you remember what happened when the people of Israel heard the voice of God? Do you remember what they did? They said, no more, no more. The voice of God shook them to their family. They said, Moses, why don't you go and talk to God? And we'll stay here and you tell us what God says. So we had no idea who God is. We think, ooh, it would be fun if God spoke to us. Yeah, fun. Fun it would not. Exhilarating it would be. But fun it would not be. So the people of Israel, they get a chance to hear God's voice. And you go. So Moses goes. But one of the few times when God did it was, you know, Jesus takes three of the sort of the inner circle of the disciples, like up this mountain. And for a moment in Mark 9, the brilliance that is Jesus shines through his humanity, and it's like he's just the shining brightness, and the cloud descends, and Moses and Elijah come and speak to Jesus about his exodus that he's about to do, his death. Peter, lovely. I like Peter. Peter, it says, Peter did not know what to say, so he said. That's my sort of guy. Right? No idea what to say, so he'll say something anyhow. And just hope it comes out okay. And Peter says, you know, it is a good thing that we're here, Lord. Let us build a sanctuary for Moses, for Elijah, the greatest of the prophets, and for you. And you remember, the Father's voice comes and it says this. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. You know, what God is saying, don't get all excited about Moses. Don't get all excited about Elijah. This is my Son. My beloved Son. It's a very, very wonderful word of rich love and tender. This is my beloved Son. And there's a sense in what God is saying to Peter is, shut up and listen. Don't talk about building sacred sites for Moses. Right? This is my Son. This is the unique moment in history. You can actually hear the one person qualified to speak. Right? That's the central claim at the heart of Christianity. The only monotheist on the planet heard it and ultimately killed him for it. There was a small group within that group who worshipped him. But there was a very clear dividing of the road around the person of Jesus. They could not pretend he was just a prophet. That was not an option Jesus left open to them. People who say Jesus is just one of the prophets are people who know nothing about who Jesus is. Right? It's just not an option if you look at the man. The deeds of Jesus, the words of Jesus. Right? The people in his day a number of times tried to kill him because they knew what he was saying. And the people most likely to understand him are his contemporaries. Do you know what I mean? Like, if his fellow Jews hear him, at one point he says, you know, why are you going to kill me? In John 5, and he says, for what good work are you going to kill me? And they said, for no good work, but because you who are a man make us about to be God. They knew exactly what he was saying. But that's another issue. We've done two things, there's one more to go. We've looked at the problem, the nature of the problem. There's 1,000 theories about an important issue. No one's qualified to speak. There is one man who comes who claims to be uniquely qualified. He is the light, or he claims to be the light of the world. He knows what's going on here. And the scary thing when you read Jesus in Matthew 7 and Matthew 25 and John 5, he actually says, on the other side of death, the key experience you'll have is you'll meet Jesus as judge. And this is one of the other freaky things Jesus says. He says, basically, what will determine heaven or hell for you, which is what he clearly believes. He doesn't believe in reincarnation. I used to believe in reincarnation. I went from being an atheist to a sort of Hindu-y, Buddhist-y thing for a while. And then finally, when I saw who Jesus was in the end, I had to reluctantly agree that he was right. But what Jesus says is that he's the judge. And it will depend not on have you been a nice person. It'll depend on whether you know him or not. So he says in a number of the parables, he speaks of, do I know you? He sends people off to hell and says, depart from me, you do evil. I never knew you. It's the relationship. So this is one of the many things that Jesus says that people can miss. That he actually says, your relationship with me is what will determine heaven or hell for you. Not have you been a nice person. Right? You, funnily enough, if you get caught up with Jesus, you will become a nice person. At least you become a lot nicer person than you would have been without him. I'm still a pest, I know that. But, you know, if I hadn't become a Christian, I'd have been even worse. I'm a hard case that God's been working on for some years. But it's actually about him. And Jesus talks about heaven and hell. And I believe in hell. I don't like believing in hell. I'd rather there wasn't a hell. I've got people I love who seem to be in danger of it. I believe in hell for one reason and one reason only. Because he does. Here's how Christianity works. We're in the dark. Because God knows our situation and loves us, he sends his son, Jesus. He becomes truly incarnated, becomes one of us, doesn't float just above the ground. He really is born of a woman, goes to the bathroom, sweats. Right? This is it's a very difficult thing to get. And I learned this actually from some of my Muslim friends in Sydney, that they get angry when they get angry when you talk about God becoming, you know, and one of them said, you know, thought it was disgusting that he should become flesh and be born from between the legs of a woman. He said, you know, trying to draw attention to how visceral, bodily fluids and yucky stuff, you know, that makes it being human. But that's it is extraordinary what it's saying. And then what Jesus does is he talks. And when you start reading the Gospels, you realize the freaky thing I remember when I started it was how often he talks about himself. You know, he's often, because he wants you to understand this, because not because he gets a buzz out of it, because you need to know, here's the light. So he talks about himself. It's a bit like, you know, if this whole thing crashed and there was an earthquake here, you know, it's like Christchurch, New Zealand, and we're all under here. But if someone comes down and says, look, I'm from the emergency services, blah, 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 blah. Why? He'd say, look, I am a doctor, I know what's going on, or I'm an engineer, something. He would talk about himself not because he wants you to go, oh, a doctor, you know, how wonderful. Or but he's telling you about himself so that you'll know how to respond to him, so that you'll take him seriously, you'll let him direct the way out rather than listen to some clown, right? So Jesus talks about himself, he talks about his father, he talks about what happens out here, he talks about you. And he is the one. So I believe in heaven and hell. Christians, healthy, humble Christians believe in heaven and hell, not because we like the idea of heaven and hell, but because he does. If he is not the Son of God, well then, make up whatever you like about what happens after death. But the question really is he who he says he is? Or can you safely dismiss him as a liar? That's an interesting position to take, why he would make up that lie, which was only ever going to kill him. If he'd just spoken as a prophet, he could have got away with that. The Jews would have argued if he was really a prophet or not, but it was the all this stuff. I'll not go down that track, because I'd like to give you some more of the evidence. But now, before I give the last point on this, do you want to ask any questions? Because if it's not clear to you, it's 99% certain it's not clear to anybody else. So anything you want to make a statement about or ask, yes, sir.
The scripture mentions that no one has seen God. Hmm. Testify, no one has seen God, and that's 100% true. And he has said, I am the image of the invisible God.
Yeah.
So, if we know that Jesus is the visible image of the invisible God, and also at the beginning in Genesis, the Bible testified that God created Adam in his own image.
Mm.
So Adam, before he took the forbidden fruit, he was the image of God too.
Yes, he was. Yes, and that's absolutely the question of the image of God, which is, again, please don't misunderstand me, this is not a view, and it's not a view that Muslims at that point disagree with the Jewish and Christian view. They don't believe man is in the image of God. They don't believe you can have anything in the image of God. But Moses very clearly says that man is made in the image of God, that there is something about being human that is godlike. There's something about humans that are very unlike God, because the Bible will say, you know, I'm not a man, God will say. You know, I'm not a man that I should lie, and things like that. And the man and God will often be contrasted in the Bible. But there's something about God chooses to make human beings with some likeness to God. And when Jesus comes and becomes one of us, that likeness is, you know.
But Jesus is the spiritual Adam. The Bible mentions also Adam.
Yes, that's an area that would be fun to go into, but with 10 minutes to go, there's the Bible will pick up almost every possible picture. Jesus is the temple. Jesus is the new Moses. Jesus is, you know, Jesus is everything. Almost everything. Jesus is the sacrifice. Jesus is both he's the temple. He's the priest in the temple. He's the sacrificial victim that the priest kills. The whole Old Testament is all pointing to Jesus to help us get some handle on the enormity of this person who is so much more than a prophet. And the parallels between Adam, you know, the destiny determining work of Adam and the destiny determining work of Jesus. And you either stand, according to the Bible, behind one of those two men. You're either in alignment with Adam, who says to God, I'll do it my way, thank you. Or you stand behind Jesus, full of grace and blood and forgiveness and life. Now why do I believe this? God could make human beings quite happily and say you live and you die. That might be what happens to animals. I think Christians have got to be very, very careful about saying that, you know, particularly to children, no, your pet budgerigar will not go to heaven. You don't know that, so shut up. Right? You shouldn't deny what the Bible doesn't deny. There may well be, and in some of the pictures of heaven there are animals anyhow, lions and lambs and stuff. Who knows? It's better, frankly, if a person is not going to be happy in heaven without their pet budgerigar or, you know, whatever, I'm sure the budgerigar will be there. But, you know, I just think better to say, just make sure you're there, and if the budgerigar's there, well, that'll be a happy reunion. But, that's always the best way. But I learned that Sunday school teachers tell children that on The Simpsons, so it must be true. Now, friends, you've got a God-given brain, and God expects you to use your brain. And John 18, verse 37 is the last verse I'd like to draw to your attention, and it says this: Jesus is on trial before Pontius Pilate. And one of the things you notice when you read through the Gospels is that when Jesus is on trial, in a sense, the person who's really on trial is the person who's assessing Jesus. And I can say exactly the same for us. When you make your assessment of Jesus, what you may not realize is that you're actually, when you think you're assessing him, you're actually passing judgment on yourself. If you come to the conclusion that God's Son is not God's Son, it will not go well for you on the judgment day. You come to the conclusion, I don't need the death of Jesus to be okay with God. You think God's been a fool? As a dear old friend of mine said, who's now dead, died recently, said, and if you get before God, if you arrive on the judgment day before God Almighty, and he says, how come you got here not forgiven by Jesus? And you say, well, I just didn't think it was all that important. This old guy John would say, God may well say to you, what do you think, I am a fool? You think I send my son to the earth to die and it's not important? You think the only way I could see to make a just and perfect forgiveness was for my son to die in your place, and you think you could get here without that? What sort of a fool do you think God is who would do that? If there was any other way to get to heaven apart from the Son of God dying, you can be sure God would have done it. Right? One of the things that's said of God is he's an economical God. Right? He will do what needs to be done. But John 18, Jesus on trial before Pontius Pilate. he's trying to, Pilate kind of knows he's innocent, but he needs to kill him for all sorts of political reasons. So he says, "Ah, you are a king then," Pilate said. Jesus said, "You say I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born, the reason I came into the world is to..." Isn't that lovely to know why you were born and why you came into the world? Jesus says, "The reason I was born, the reason I came into the world is to testify to the truth." Right? And here's where you and I get very much involved. Jesus then says, "Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Right? You want to know if you're really interested in the truth? According to Jesus, you'll show up because you listen to him. You make the time, you take the time to listen to him. Anyone who claims to be searching for the truth, Jesus says, but couldn't be bothered to listen to the one person who makes the sorts of claims that Jesus makes and has had the sort of impact that Jesus had, by far the largest religion in the world, by far the most influential man in history, and for good, and yet searching for truth, but not look at that. Jesus, you are deceiving yourself. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. So do make sure you've taken the time to listen to Jesus. And the great thing, how do you get to listen to Jesus? Well, very clear in John's Gospel, they're all great, but I'm particularly in love with John's Gospel at the moment. John's an eyewitness of it, and he's very clear. He saw Jesus do these things, and the evidence historically is crystal clear that he was there. But you're not there. So John becomes like your eyes. It's a bit like something happening around that corner up the steps, and there's someone there who's looking, and for some reason you can't see it, and they're describing to you what they're seeing. You may want to see it, but you're not in the right place. But you're only one step removed. And John is writing down what he saw and writing down what he heard, so you can see and hear through his eyes. Most of what you know about your family's history, much of your life, is because other people saw you do it, heard you do it, thought it was cute and remembered it and told you. Even your story about where you were born, you have the faintest clue where you were born. Right? Other people told you. You didn't come out of your mother's womb and go, "Oh, Singapore, how interesting." I thought it was nearly Hong Kong, but we just got here in time. But you know, you just listen, other people tell you. So to listen to Jesus. Jesus, in the end, the question Jesus is constantly asking in different ways is said really clearly in Mark 8 when he says, "Who do you say that I am?" Jesus asked that question, say, in Mark chapter 8. He doesn't walk up to people who know nothing about him and say, "Tell me, who do you think I am?" Right? He lets them spend a couple of years with him, watching him, listening to him. Then he says, "What's your opinion?" And that is the question he and his father want to know of you. What is your opinion of Jesus? Have you taken the time to listen to him? To read the closest sources we have, written by eyewitnesses, or Luke's Gospel, who tells us he wasn't an eyewitness, but he spoke to the eyewitnesses. He's very honest. He could have lied if he wanted to. Who could have told? But he didn't. He said, "I didn't see him. But I went around and talked to the eyewitnesses. I've written you a nice orderly report." To listen to Jesus. Right? And to let him speak to you. Now, we've got 2 minutes. Is there life after death? Nobody knows. If this guy's not a liar, we do know. Right? And it's wonderfully good news that there's a heaven that you can be forgiven by the grace of God and mercy, and there's also hell, that to be absent from God and all that comes from him forever and ever. So life becomes both joyful and serious. Which actually is what humans want, I think, a life that is of substance and matters, but is also joyful. Any questions? Yeah. That's a good question, and it's a question that the Bible says little about. It actually talks in two different ways about it, depending on the problem it's dealing with. The question was, what happened? So my father, who became a Christian late in life, died in 2000. Well, he's been dead for 13 years. Where is he? Well, sometimes the Bible will speak about him sleeping. Sometimes the Bible will speak about him being with Jesus. When some of the Christians were worried that people were dying before Jesus came back, he says, "Don't worry, they're asleep. And when he comes back, They will be with us on that great day. Jesus says to the guy next to him who died, the thief, one of the very few men we know who's in heaven, you know, again, trusting the Jesus who he says is this dirty little criminal who turned to Jesus in the last bit, you know, he knew he was going to be dead by sundown. Jesus says, today you're going to be with me in paradise. So the Apostle Paul says, I long to die and be with Christ. So Christians do differ on that. I think the Bible's much more concerned to say, what if they think, if you die tonight, your next experience will be the face of Jesus, with the judgment in Jesus. Whether or not you sleep for a few months, years, decades, hundreds of years, will be irrelevant to you. And I think the Bible's much more concerned about, it's more like a St. John's Ambulance Handbook than it is like a big, huge medical textbook. It wants to tell you, is your leg broken? Here's how to fix it. The Bible's much more pragmatic than I'd like it to be. So it tends at times to give bits and pieces of answers. It's really concerned about how to live well. So it tells you. So that I've got some Christian friends who think that, I tend to think that my old man's with Jesus. But I've got one or two friends who think, no, he's asleep. And I think, well, I don't care. I just know that he's not going to miss out on the second coming. And he's okay. Is that all right? Yeah.
How do you reconcile what Jesus said in Luke 16 when he talks about the poor Lazarus who goes to heaven and then this rich guy who went to hell? And this big gulf between the heaven and hell. Jesus seems to have told this really weird story.
What am I reconciling it with? Yes.
That was Jesus who said those
things. It's his story, yeah.
So, there's nothing about resurrection in the end.
The rest of the things he said. I've got to be disciplined here, haven't I? Because we've nearly got to finish. Luke 16, verses 19 on. It's one of the stories that really shapes my whole inner headspace. The story Jesus tells, aimed at rich, arrogant religious people who thought that Jesus' teaching about the dangers of money was stupid. And he tells them a story about a rich guy who's got a poor guy at his door, longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. They both die. The poor guy goes to heaven, is with Abraham, is a very Jewish way of talking about heaven, he's with Abraham. The ex-rich guy is now in hell. He seeks for relief for himself and is told there is none. He's concerned that his brothers are on earth, obviously like him, and he wants Lazarus to be sent as a messenger. And the punch in the story is where Abraham says, they have Moses and the prophets. That is, they've got the word of God. Let them listen to that. The arrogant, unrepentant man in hell says, no, that's not good enough. I'll tell you what they need if the man will go back from the dead. And the punch in the story, as Abraham says in Jesus' story, even if someone rises from the dead, right, if they won't listen to the prophets, they won't listen to that. And the irony is that Jesus knows, and we know, that's in fact what happened. Jesus did rise from the dead, did prove that he had been there, done that, conquered death, which will conquer all of us. And on the whole, the rich and powerful didn't repent. Because the problem isn't evidence, the problem is the human heart. We tend to believe what we want to believe. The key thing there is basically, why does the rich man go to hell? Because there's two rich men in the story. Abraham is a filthy rich guy in his day. He was a multi-millionaire in his day, Abraham. He's in heaven with the ex-poor guy, and the ex-rich guy's in hell. So it's not because they're rich that they're in heaven or hell, because there's one in each. But it's because Peter Jensen, who was the principal of the Bible College when I trained, he put it like this. If you've got the Bible in your hand and the poor man at your gate and you don't bring the two together, you're not listening to the Bible. You cannot step over the man longing to have the crumbs from your table and give them nothing and pretend to be someone who's listening to God when you're called to love your neighbours, the basic command. So it's actually, although it's not spelt out as nicely as we might like it to be, that's why the guy goes to hell. Because he's saying to God, I don't care what you say. Right? I mean, that's what we say to God. I don't give a damn what you say. Shut up. I'm not caring for the poor. I'm making more money. And if you say that to God, I mean, if you do that to the poor, if you don't love your neighbour, you are giving God the rude finger. That's why the guy goes to hell. So I don't think there's anything to reconcile. I mean, we know more as the story goes on that the reason why the poor guy's in heaven is also because he died for. But the key thing before the cross, Jesus is trying to say to the rich religious hypocrites he's dealing with, you are in danger of going to hell forever unless you start loving God with your money. Is that okay? I think one more question, then we better stop. Huh? Yeah. 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 Yeah, I take it that the people who are in paradise now, they're not in heaven as it's going to be. The new heaven and the new earth that God's going to create, and we're going to get our new bodies and all that, that the Bible just barely sketches out, because I don't know how you can describe that. Paradise, it's the word for garden. It's a cool, refreshing garden. So it's a picture of a lovely place to be with God. And here's one of the differences, again, between the Islamic view of heaven and the Jesus view of heaven, is that God is not present in... and I'm not trying to be rude, it's just helpful to realise the massive differences. That the goal for in the Quran is not to be with God, it's to be in paradise with the way it's described by Muhammad. And whereas the goal in the Bible is to be with Jesus and to be with the Father. But the new heaven and the new earth is what we're waiting for. New body. It's going to be... it's hard to describe. The Bible never really tries to describe it. It's like describing life to a child in the womb. How do you do that? Okay, well, look, thank you for your patience. If you're interested, if you haven't read anything on the resurrection of Jesus, because in the end when Jesus is asked a few times, give us proof that you are the Son of God, twice, in John 2 and Matthew 12, Jesus talks about his resurrection. And this is a very simple... article, there's parts of it have been cut off, sorry, at the edge, which will go through some of the evidence for Jesus. That's the sort of thing that might help you. If you've been a Christian for 1,000 years, don't take it, I've only got a few. But if you've never had a chance to read something like this, it's designed for uni students, so it's got pictures. Yeah. You can pass those around, flyers, and just take one if you want to take it home and read it, otherwise, leave it for the poor. Thanks, Sam. Very much.
But I believe we have a lot of other questions, and I do have questions that I couldn't ask, but I will definitely ask later, maybe. Well, we want to thank Ian for coming to Roundtable tonight. It's fantastic, and I hope that you have been blessed by the talk. Just as a gratitude from us, we have something for you, which is your $50.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.